Oh, thank you very much, Jacob. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm here to talk with Joanna Schaffhausen again, and this time in our Annalisa Vega series, in which this title is Dead and Gone. Now, Annalisa is working in my hometown, sort of. I didn't grow up in Chicago, but rather north of Chicago. But it feels like going home to read one of these books. Chicago PD has always had a kind of mixed reputation, shall we say, right?
Yeah, I think that's true of most police departments these days, but Chicago maybe more than some.
Right. And so you've decided to give this woman who becomes a cop, she became a whistleblower on her own father and brother. And she appears to be a person whose ethics are uncompromising, and therefore perhaps she's not entirely suited to being a cop. It's hard to say. So when you set this up, did you expect it to be a series when you wrote the first one?
I did not. I expected Gone for Good, which is the first in the series, to be a standalone. And then the publisher said, we'd like to make it a series. And well, that's very exciting. Obviously, more books. I like Annalisa as a character. She's very fun. So the idea of writing more books about her is definitely appealing. But I really struggled with the second book because I didn't plan for her to continue. So figuring out what that would look like and where her character would go took some time. The third book here, Dead and Gone, was much easier.
Right. Well, it's almost like a three-act drama, isn't it? The way this all works out. Do you expect to continue writing her?
Yeah, there'll be at least two more after this one. I've actually written four already. Wow. So that one comes out next year.
Great. I forgot to mention that Joanne very kindly signed copies of this, which just came. So her publication date was Tuesday. So congratulations on that. But I'm holding one of our, Patrick usually does this, but I will open the book and show it. It was exciting because until it came, I hadn't read this book. And so I told Joanne she might be asking all the questions for our conversation today. But anyway, you can see that she has actually signed our copies. You have a very neat signature.
Oh, thank you.
You do. Right. So if I were to ask you to sum up Dead and Gone without giving away anything much, what would you say?
A bit of an homage to a crime novel, detective novel that I loved back in the 90s by Carolyn Hart called Death in Lover's Lane. And in that one, her sleuth Henry O is working as a college professor, and she has a student who is trying to figure out a journalism project. And the student is trying to figure out which of three crime cases to write about. And so Henry says, well, explore all three and figure out which is the best one. You'll know which one has legs. And then the student turns up dead. So now it's upon Henry O to figure out which of these three stories that the student was investigating led to her death. So that's the sort of structure, right? It's four mysteries. There's what happened to the investigator who was poking around. And then the three different mysteries. And so in my story, Annalisa is called to the scene of a death of a private eye who used to be a cop, and his name is Sam Tran. And he was buddies with Annalisa's boss. So she's taking his death really hard. And she wants, one of her best cops, Annalisa, who she knows will follow the answer to the very end, even if it's an ugly one, she will find out what happened to Sam. So her boss gives Annalisa the case, figure out what happened to Sam. He's a PI and his personal life was squeaky clean. So Annalisa figures in his private investigations, he uncovered some kind of secret and that's what led to his death. And he was working on three cases at the time. And it's kind of like Monty Hall's Let's Make a Deal, where it's three doors and one of them has a murderer behind it in this case. And Annalisa has to figure out which of these three doors led to Sam Tran's death. So that's four mysteries she has to solve. What happened to Sam? And then she has to solve all three of his open cases.
One of which, one of the cases has in fact been given to him by Annalisa's brother.
Yes, which that's one of the
Surprise. Yeah, which, you know, once again, brings her family back into focus, because she's already riven her family by whistleblowing on her father, who was a cop, and yep. her older brother. And so now if her, actually, Vinny's her older brother, if I remember right.
Yeah, he's the oldest, yeah.
Right. So if Vinny is now involved in a suspicious death, where's that going to go? And it's actually turns out that it's Vinny's daughter that Vinny thinks is being stalked on campus. So we get a sort of dark academic thing going here. That Sam was supposed to be trying to identify whoever was harassing the daughter. So Vinny's not guilty of a crime. I mean,
no.
It seems unlikely he'd be stalking his own daughter. So I was relieved that, you know, that wasn't going to be further decimation to Annalisa's family. That would be hard, you know. I mean, she skips her family Sunday dinners, for example, and I can see why. What in the world would you talk about?
Yeah, it's awkward.
It's your family situation.
Yeah, Annalisa sort of fallen out with her once very close family over the events of the first book. And we're now in the third book, so those are reverberating. But yeah, when she shows up to Sam Tran's death, his phone rings, you know, on the dead body, and it's her brother on the other end wanting an update on his case. So Annalisa is a little ticked when she finds out that her brother Vinny hired Sam to look into this stalker on his daughter's campus rather than coming to Annalisa. You know, he's got an in on the police force, and still he goes around her and hires a PI. So her sisterly pride and her investigatory pride is a little wounded. But now Sam's dead, and Annalisa is, of course, going to step in. Not that Vinny is terribly excited about that prospect.
No, he isn't. And actually, I'm not sure, you know, police people don't get to freelance. So, you know, if he had brought it to Annalisa, she would have had to do it outside her capacity as a serving police officer. So really, hiring a private investigator like Sam makes more sense, I think.
And that is one of the walls that Annalisa runs into, is that the campus is outside of Chicago. So she has no official authority at all on campus. And the campus cops are not happy to see her. So, you know, the fact that she can't actually go in there and just flash her badge and make things happen kind of is very frustrating to her.
Yeah, well, she has a real run-in with Officer Ken. Fairly early on when they go into the woods to there's a potential crime against one of the students, a young woman, and Annalisa insists on going to the crime scene, and he isn't at all happy to have her there.
No, he is not
in the woods, you know. So I think, you know, so often in when you have professionals in law enforcement, regardless of whether it's the FBI or the police or the U.S. Marshals Service, whatever, you can build in conflict with jurisdictional disputes.
Yep.
It appears to me that people in law enforcement are very territorial.
Sometimes they definitely are.
Maybe not. Maybe it's only in fiction. I mean, you know,
I think in real life it happens too.
Okay. It does come up a lot.
Yeah, I remember seeing a true crime case from not that long ago where the killer had attacked two people in two different towns that happened to have different police forces that didn't talk to each other. So the investigator who finally solved it and realized the cases were related saw the other one on the news, like the local news, and was like, oh, that sounds like our case. Maybe we should talk to each other. So they were literally like, you know, blocks apart kind of thing. But because it was a jurisdictional difference, the two different police forces didn't realize they were dealing with the same killer until they saw on the news.
Where have you put this? I'm trying to remember. Is it a college or university? Which is it?
It's a university, but it's a fake university.
Right. But where did you decide, so theoretically?
It's south of the city.
Okay, so you're going south, whereas in fact, the real universities around Chicago are generally north, like Northwestern on the lake. The University of Chicago is in the southern part of Chicago, but it's definitely in the city.
Yeah.
Very, very different vibe from Northwestern. And then Loyola and Mundelein. Mundelein is a college, I think. Two Catholic institutions when I was young. Mundelein was women and Loyola was a men's college. And then I have no idea what other things they've proliferated since. I mean, the University of Illinois is way down south in Champaign, Illinois. Yep. And I think there are other branches of the University of Illinois, because most state universities seem to have proliferated, you know, various branches and various to suit their system. I can't believe how many Arizona State University has and the University of Arizona is in Tucson, but and then there's, you know, another Northern Arizona in Flagstaff, and then there's a whole community college circle. We have a Scottsdale Community College and whatever. So there are really loads of places to go for higher education. And I don't know, bouncing back from COVID, how much disruption, you know, classes online and not being able to go out. I don't have any idea what that's really done to the higher education system.
I'm not sure. My daughter was in fifth grade when COVID hit. And so that's really only my personal experience.
Right. Well, it hasn't been great for, you know, early education, but I don't know whether the older students who presumably were more sophisticated online and so forth.
I don't think it was great for anybody.
No, because part of college, you know, is sort of learning to leave home and navigate in the real world. And if you don't do that, if you're going to college by sitting in your childhood bedroom on your computer, you're missing a chunk of what the point of going to college was in the first place. But in your book, you do have, you actually have people living in a co-ed dorm. Benny's daughter is living in a co-ed dorm. Is that, do you think, kind of the norm now?
It was when I was on campus, now almost 30 years ago, I guess.
Well, when I was on campus, which was a lot longer ago than that, we had very segregated dorms at Stanford. It changed some with the overseas campus program, but I don't think it changed in Palo Alto. So again, I'm not too sure how I feel about, you know, a co-ed dorm living in one. I mean,
it was fine.
Was it?
Yeah. I don't recall any specific issues related to the co-ed.
I think it would be, you know, you'd have to be dressed instead of wandering out to the hall.
Maybe. You would think that, but it turns out not really.
No.
Not everybody followed that rule.
Oh, okay. Well, there you are. What do I know? I'm dated. Anyway, so daughter lives in a co-ed dorm where there are ugly messages on doors and whatever. But what is that? There's in the opening part, there's a party. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're introducing a whole campus case.
Yeah, the campus case of the stalker is actually the A plot of the book. So there's, you know, five mysteries in the book, but they're not all equal. And Sam's death is the inciting event. It's the thing that kicks off the investigation, but he's more the thread kind of running through the story. Rather than the main focus. The main focus is actually who's doing the stalking on the campus. Early on, because Annalisa doesn't have any official jurisdiction and the campus cops maintain that there is no stalker, there's not a lot she can do. So her niece, Vinny's daughter, who's the would-be potential victim in all of this, kind of starts poking around on her own. So she is one of the other narrators. And that is one of the ways I can get away with writing five mysteries in one book is because, well, Annalisa is investigating some of the other cases that Sam had. Quinn handles the initial stalking stuff. And then when the stalking case gets really heated and Quinn's in over her head, Annalisa can join her on the A plot. But no, for Quinn, a while, it's Quinn carrying that.
Sorry. To clarify, Quinn is her niece, right?
Yes, Quinn's her niece.
Right. So Quinn's in college. Quinn is now getting some investigative experience. Is that a thread you're planning to develop?
No particular plans. She's cooking in college for a while now. Now that the stalker has been resolved, she can be a normal college kid for a while.
So you seem to like really complicated plots. What is it? I mean, that's a lot to juggle in a book. Does that mean that you really have to sit down and plan them out?
I mean, yes, to some degree for this one in particular. They're not all this complicated. I think this is probably my most complex story because it has so many different mysteries. And with every mystery, you have to have, you know, victims and suspects. So the characters do add up. I have some tricks that I employ that make it a little easier to follow which case is which. For example, all the narrators who are not Annalisa relate to the stalking case. So if you are hearing from anybody who's not Annalisa, it's the stalking case, which again is the main plot. So that helps you orient which case we're talking about where.
As you've been writing along, have you found yourself actually gravitating towards more complicated plots to keep your interest level up?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say it necessarily has to be complicated. So book four, again, which I've already written and comes out next year, has a much more limited cast. And it's more of a cat and mouse game between Annalisa and a Chicago neurosurgeon who may or may not be a good sociopath. And so, you know, she has to figure out, is he a good sociopath or is he a bad sociopath? So they have a little bit of a cat and mouse thing going on.
When you say cat and mouse, what do you mean by that?
You know, kind of like Tom and Jerry, where they're chasing each other around. So it becomes more about like, is this guy evil? If so, can Annalisa prove it? Because the inciting event there is that this professor wrote a book, The Good Sociopath, about this neurosurgeon, Craig Canning, and she wants to publish the book. It's coming out, it's getting tons of press. And then a few weeks before it's supposed to launch, there's a possible murder in Craig Canning's apartment building. A woman plunges to her death off the balcony. And so
the professor, Vladimir Putin case.
Yeah, who wrote the book about the good sociopath is now concerned that he's responsible and he isn't a good sociopath after all. So she wants Annalisa to look into the case and try to figure out, is this guy bad or is he good? Did he do this murder? Is it even a murder? And so it is a much more limited cast and it's more of a psychological thriller, yeah. I would say. And yes, like I want to write slightly different things every time. That's partly how I stay interested.
So when we first talked, weren't we talking about a different series? I'm pretty sure that you had written books about a different character.
Yep. That's Ellery Hathaway.
He had a very complicated backstory. And what are there, three books about Ellery or four?
There's five.
Five, okay. Are you planning on doing anything more with Ellery?
Not at this time. Like five ends in a good place.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't say never, but for the moment I'm writing Annalisa and there are no Ellery books under contract.
I really liked her, but I do think, as you say, you may have said everything you needed to say about her situation and where she gets to. I thought it was a really interesting concept for a series, and I liked Ellery and some of the other players. Did you write? I'm trying to remember. I'm really not quite up to snuff here. Did you write an Annalisa, Anna, Ellery? Didn't you mix them up there for a book or two?
I published both in 1 year, but Ellery and Annalisa have never met.
I didn't mean that, but I meant you were still writing Ellery and you wrote Annalisa, and it seemed to me that, but then Ellery with book five, you sort of that was it. And now you're writing. Annalisa, are you a person who likes to start series or start different characters?
I mean, yeah, it's always fun to explore new characters. I'd like to write a standalone. I think that would be fun. But yeah, I'm not closing the door on any other series. And who knows what will happen with Annalisa. Like I said, she'll be at least 5 books and then we'll see.
Well, sometimes, you know, that's about the length of a character arc. And I just wondered, it seems to me you're a person who would actually like writing standalones where everybody's in jeopardy and you can blow up the whole world when you're writing it. A handicap of the series is you can't really do a lot of damage to Annalisa.
It's true. Although, like, I have put her through the ringer. Somebody was asking me, I think at the launch, about, you know, which is easier, Annalisa or Ellery. And like, to me, whether it's easy or hard depends on the individual book. And it doesn't really have to do with the character per se, but I feel like they started quite different and they're sort of meeting in the middle, where Ellery, because she survived a serial killer at age 14, you know, in adulthood, was pretty closed off and like distrusting and couldn't figure out how to live her life outside the shadow of this serial killer. And she didn't want to form relationships. And, you know, gradually she gets some friends and a relationship and she gets a real job and she starts to feel like she does have a life beyond being this famous victim of a serial killer. So she becomes sort of less angry and less alone. Whereas Annalisa starts with this really close family in Chicago and a, you know, a tight knit group on the force. And then she, by the end of the first book, she's blown it all up. And so she's a little bitter about the outcome there, where neither of her families, her cop family and her actual family, trust her anymore. I see reader complaints sometimes that, you know, she's always out there on her own. Why isn't she waiting for backup? And it's like, backup wouldn't come, you know, like Annalisa's really kind of by herself. So, you know, they started off different and then they became more alike, and sort of Annalisa's now arc has to be moving her back more towards the middle.
Well, Annalisa strikes me, as I said earlier, a person who's going to have trouble navigating the Chicago Police Department because her standards are pretty rigid, you know, her dedication to the truth, regardless of the fallout, yep. Which is certainly true in this book. And, you know, that makes her an admirable person, but I don't know that it makes her a comfortable person. And I'm not sure that it means that she is going to be embraced in her profession, because there's a lot of gray, it seems to me, in a cop's life. It isn't as clear cut as Annalisa would like it to be, hence her family. Although, you know, at some point you do have to take a stand when you see something as obvious as what was wrong in the first book.
Yep. No, I think Annalisa made the right decision there. And, you know, police corruption has kind of been an issue she's faced in a number of places. But I think in this book, it's less about actual corruption and more the limits of what she can do within the boundaries of her job as a policewoman. Like, one of Sam's open cases is about a mom who went missing at a New Year's Eve party in 1989. She went to this party and she never came home. And she had a very young daughter at the time who's grown up without her mom. And now she's pregnant with her first child. And she feels like she doesn't know how to be a mom and can't be a mom until she knows what happened to her mom. And so she hired, Sam Tran to figure that out. And so she's upset when Sam is killed, but then relieved because here's Annalisa, and Annalisa will find out what happened to her mom. And Annalisa has to explain to her, like, this is a, you know, 30-year-old case. Like, the cops are not going to be devoting resources. They can't, they have a budget, you know, they can't be chasing a 30-year-old missing persons case. They have current missing people that they have to look for that they might actually find. So this is a place where Annalisa bumps up against the, you know, rules of her job and what it is and what it isn't. And absolutely. Yeah, it's not entirely comfortable with that. She has to tell this woman, like, sorry, I can't help you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, the cops are not really there to work cold cases. Well, increasingly cold case units have come back and people are writing about them. But the reality is they have so much crime to deal or so many cases to deal with in the present that unless there's some attention or breaking thing or whatever, I mean, you have to admire the cops that pursued the Long Island serial killer, which we've all been reading about. You know, that's a long time case. And yet somebody kept an eye on it to the point where they were finally able to.
I think would-be serial killers do get pursued. You know, even if they're not in the news, the cops, there's usually somebody working those cases.
Well, murder cases are never actually closed as compared to, you know, other things. But still, you have to admire the perseverance, you know, of the cops who kept working that. But I had a conversation earlier today with Catherine Ryan Howard in Ireland, and her book is built upon missing women. And, you know, the reality is, as we were just saying, that the police really can't keep working, you know, these missing person cases. They hope that maybe a lead will arrive or, you know, there'll be some sort of a break, but they haven't got enough resources or personnel to really dig into it.
They just look very hard for whatever reason. Like, this mom was an alcoholic and kind of unreliable. So, you know, there wasn't a lot. They assumed she just was on a drunken binge somewhere, maybe ran off with another guy. Like, nobody's looking for her all that hard.
Well, missing adults are often thought to be missing voluntarily, whereas missing children do get a lot more attention because it's not generally assumed that they went. You know, we just had a case here in Arizona where I'm trying to remember, she was Navajo, but anyway, whatever, disappeared when she was 14. And all of a sudden she surfaced like 5 years later and apparently okay and unharmed. And now the question is, what happened? You know, where'd she go and why did she go and where's she been? All those questions. But that's pretty rare for a missing child, you know, to be recovered like that. But let's go back to Sam, because Sam was Annalisa's boss's partner. And then he left the PD 5 years or so before he served his 20 to get his full pension. So what was it that, do you tell us, what was it that drove Sam to retire early and become a private investigator?
Yeah, he blew the whistle on a little overtime scheme that some of his unit had going. And so in revenge, they kept tagging him with like drugs in his locker and kiddie porn and all. And he finally had enough of it and was like, I'm leaving. I'm not going to take this anymore.
So actually Annalisa then has something in common with Sam, which is both of them serving in the Chicago PD decided that, they were not going to turn away from, you know, clear wrongdoing. And in Sam's case, he left. Annalisa is still there. So, you know, if you're going to progress the series and this is going to keep happening to her, at some point, she's going to have to make some clear career choices, isn't she?
Yeah, she has to decide. I mean, so the counter to this is Lynn Zimmer, her boss and Sam's partner. So Sam was also Vietnamese American, and Lynn Zimmer is Black. And so one of the reasons they paired up is that like the white boys didn't want to work with them back in the day. So they rode together. And when Sam left, Lynn Zimmer decided to stay with and sort of fight within the force. And as a result, she has risen through the ranks to where she's the commander now. And she has used her position to help Annalisa and, you know, help root out corruption and everything. So she's chosen to fight within, whereas Sam just, you know, left. So Annalisa has to decide which of these paths is for her.
Well, I remember that somewhere there you said that Sam was, you know, advised that he'd be better off to turn a blind eye, and he just couldn't do it. And that's why I'm saying, I think that for a person like that and a person like Annalisa, being in the PD may be, you know, a stressful fit if compromise is required. So what makes you interested in writing about cops?
I think they are interesting. They hold a lot of power in our society, and that could be used for really good or really bad things. Partially, it's just what I know from my background in studying how they do their business all these years. I sort of have trouble imagining a series, like I've read them, you know, the cozy series that are built around like the local baker who solves lots of crimes. And I just am like, how many crimes can the baker solve? Like, you know, it's like Cabot Cove with Jessica Fletcher. Like, how many murders can there really be in this one little town in Maine? And as much as I enjoy the episodes, I couldn't write them, you know, like, I don't believe them. I don't believe that this one woman would, the writer would solve all of these crimes where the professional investigator can't. And if I don't like believe it at my core, I can believe it enough to watch it and enjoy it or to read it, but I can't write it. I can believe a one-off, you know, and any individual, but I can't, I guess I can, it's not that I can't believe it. I can't sell it at myself. Like other people, they make me believe it, you know, great cozy writers. I can't do it. So for me, it either has to be like a standalone where you can understand why in these very specific conditions, it has to be the baker who solves the crime, or it has to be somebody who has a reason to be investigating, whether that's an investigative journalist, a private investigator, or a cop.
Or more recently, true crime podcasters have come to muscle in to private eye roles. And I think in part, it's because the old fashioned private eye, the gumshoe who was actually out, you know, walking around and all the rest of it is not really a job so much anymore. I mean, a lot of it has moved into, you know, in cyber investigation and so forth. And so there are books written by true crime podcasters because publishers love the idea that they already have an audience. So I've seen that. But then I've also seen a number of novels where, in fact, the investigator is a true crime podcast or plays a role. Actually, in the current Lincoln Lawyer season 2 of the TV series, not the original movie, there is a true crime podcaster who is ethically challenged, shall we say. But it's clear that, you know, he has an audience and he wants to be the hero. You know, everybody wants to be the hero of their own story now. And as long as you have a phone, you have, you know, a reasonable chance of doing that. And so we're seeing, I think, a lot more people thrusting themselves into investigations that don't belong there.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
You know, really, yeah, I mean, it really is. And sometimes they can be helpful, but I think this is going to become, Catherine and I were talking about this, an increasing problem for law enforcement is dealing, you know, with the social media investigations and the pressure, the flash mob kind of thing, or people just stumbling out into the crime scenes with their phones, you know, hoping to get video. I mean, it's getting harder and harder to do anything private and public. There's always somebody there with a phone. You know, in Britain, it's CCTV. And so, you know, if you watch British cop shows and all, which I really like, the first thing Vera will say, for example, is check all the CCTV, you know, because there's hardly an inch of Britain, as far as I can tell, that's not under surveillance. But we don't really have that here in the US. So what we have is, you know, people with cell phones.
And the criminals, you know, are always doing the crimes with their cell phones. I can't believe they haven't figured this out yet.
I know, isn't it amazing?
On your cell phone doing your crime.
I know, I love it. I mean, if you look at, you know, we had a vandal, a sort of a post George Floyd opportunity for a flash mob to come to the big expensive mall here in Scottsdale and, you know, just generally vandalize it, you know, hit the Mercedes dealer, hit the Apple store, just have a great time. They all brought their phones and they all took pictures and put themselves on social media. So it really wasn't rocket science for the police to run them all down and identify them and arrest them or whatever. And, you know, you're right. You think, there seems to be some weird idea that there's a cone of privacy that somehow envelops you and your cell phone.
Yeah.
You know, that nobody's going to notice. It's just amazing.
There's a lot of dumb criminals out there. My favorite was the guy who knew enough not to bring his cell phone with him. So he bought like a temporary burner phone, but he paid for it with his credit card.
There you go. Once again.
So they were very easily able to trace it back to him.
Well, the Darwin Awards are expanding. There's no question about that. But, you know, I can see that if you're writing crime fiction, whether you're writing cop novels, or even if you want to go out of the cop shop and into some other kind of investigator, that you're going to have to deal with this increasing public, you know, participation or witnessing. Maybe that's the word I want. You know, the increasing number of people who are filming it and, you know, available as witnesses and so forth. And, you know, as a person who had legal training, I know that, you know, eyewitnesses are notoriously unreliable, but I don't know that cell phone, you know, imaging is unreliable. It's one thing for a person to say, yeah, I think it was the guy in the lineup, you know, that is the number five with whatever it all is, but if they have an actual photo on their cell phone, that is a totally different animal.
It's true.
So, I mean, I think you crime writers are always up against advancing technology. You either have to make it historical, or you have to figure out how to disable it, or, you know, because I got a thing today, I could hardly believe it, from the American Bookseller Association saying that they wanted all their members, of which we are one, to develop an AI policy and sit down and go through it with your staff. And if you're a unionized bookstore, you have to check all the provisions of it against your contract and all. I said to Rob, there's no one on my staff, except maybe the store manager, who would even know AI or what to do with it if it showed up. So I'm not going to worry about AI training. It's not going to come up. But I was fascinated with the idea that all of a sudden, here's something, you know, that we're supposed to take a position on.
Yeah. It's here.
You know, it's just intruding right into, you know, like retail life. So It must be even more of an issue if you're in law enforcement, or, you know, if you're a writer of crime fiction or something. You have to decide, you know, whether AI is going to be intrusive or part of your life or whatever. I like to think that I can recognize your voice even if some AI guy comes along and tries to mimic it, but this may actually become an issue. You know, did Joanne actually write her book, or is this, you know, some fan fiction, some AI person decided to write an Annalisa Vega book and pass it off? Yeah. Maybe part of the clue would be who's the publisher.
Yeah, that would be a clue.
Or, you know, are publishers going to have some way to, you know, some sort of gateway thing? I mean, I said to Rob, well, couldn't I just ask the publisher, my husband, you know, why can't I just ask the publisher? And he said, what if they don't know? You know, what if you were to submit a book written by Chatbox or something, would the publisher actually know?
I mean, at the college they probably would, but
I don't know. I mean, I just see that this is a whole new, you know, a whole new thing opening up here, Dan. As a crime writer, you're going to have to, and a professional writer, you're really going to have to think about. So there's no end to the kind of plots that are opening up in front of us. It's like spy fiction, you know, forever we were in the sandbox because after 9/11, and now they're all pivoting back to the Cold War. Russia is once again
the bad guy again. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I just had Daniel Silva and Brad Thor 2 days apart, and in both cases, you know, the Russians were the evil actors. And, you know, I think if you're writing thrillers and trying to mirror the real world, you have to kind of keep switching, you know, to whatever theater is the most. I hope it won't be North Korea next. I really do, because I don't want them to become the theater. But anyway, what fun for you. And you seem to enjoy it so much.
I mean, yes, I enjoy writing. So I don't want to pass that off to Chatbox or whatever. It's no fun for me. But yeah, I mean, technology is something you sort of have to keep up with and figure out how it would relate to your story, or in the case of AI, your career.
Yeah, no, definitely so. I think about my friend Sue Grafton, who didn't make it to Z, but you know, her decision to stay in the 1980s probably looks better and better. if you think about it, she didn't have to deal with that. Well, let's call Jacob up and see whether we have any questions from the audience. I did ask you, and you've talked to us about the fact there will be another book coming out. The other most common questions we get are about writing process. So maybe, Jacob, do we have anybody who's asking Joanne anything about that?
Nothing specifically on that, but if you wanted to maybe explain your writing process, where you get your inspiration from usually, or?
Well, as any writer will tell you, ideas are everywhere. You know, something somebody says at the dinner table, something you saw on the subway, a book you read, a movie you saw, like ideas are just all over the place. I usually start with the crime, why is it interesting, this particular crime, and then who would do the crime, so that you have, you know, the killer or whatever the crime is, the thief, and some suspects. Who else would want the whatever it is that was stolen, or who else would want to kill this person? And so you start populating your story. And then who will be the investigator in a series? That's a given. It's going to be Annalisa as your primary investigator. So that's like checked off already. And then how is it solved? So I always know, you know, who did it and why, and what's going to be the giveaway. So I know, you know, what kind of clues I'm going to be planting and how the killer will eventually be tripped up. So I have a roadmap when I start writing.
So you're more of a plotter than a pantser, is the current?
I mean, I'm a planter, but I'm definitely more of a plotter, I think. Than I admire the pantsers so much, who just sit down and like, oh, here's an idea and go. I mostly can't work that way. I'd find it terrifying. It's like watching, you know, walking a tightrope without the net.
But I'll bet as you're working along, even though you've got the main points and all, that there are things that work up that surprise you.
Sure. The other narrator in the Ellery series is an FBI agent named Reed Markham. And in one of the books, Reed gets shot. And I didn't plan that. I'm just riding along and all of a sudden there he is getting shot on the page. And I'm like, oh, Reed, sorry. You got shot. So sometimes you do get surprises.
Anything else, Jacob?
Yeah, we have a few. When can we expect the fourth book?
A year from now. So August 2024. It should be called All the Way Gone, which is sort of a synonym for crazy or nuts. And that's one of the central questions of the book, is whether Craig Canning is our good psychopath or a bad psychopath. Is he in fact all the way gone?
I like that.
Yeah, that'll be out 2024. It's up on Goodreads, so it's official. It exists.
We had a question about any more visits, in-person book tour visits?
A few, but they're mostly in New England.
Okay.
But you can look at my website. I have a couple more to add. JoannaSchaffhausen.com is usually pretty updated. I have a new one at the Harvard Coop, which will be September 21st. I don't think that's up there yet.
Nice.
But I'm actually going to Europe for the next couple of weeks.
Yay. You are?
Yes.
Where? How exciting.
London and then Paris.
Wow.
So this is a vacation that was supposed to happen in 2020 and has been long postponed. It's a little awkward since I just had the book came out, but like this was the timing that works with the child starting school and in camp. So had to be in August, and that's the time we had booked 3 years ago. And so we're finally going. It should be fun.
Great.
And then one more question. Would you recommend reading the previous two books, or does this stand up pretty well as a standalone?
you can read it as a standalone. You shouldn't be lost at all. The thing about the Annalisa series is I do have to keep spoiling the first book over and over. Like, not in detail, but I, like, because of the way it ends, there is no way to not really spoil the end of the first book. So if you want to get the full experience unspoiled, I recommend starting with the first one, which is Gone for Good. The second one is long gone. It's just out in paperback this week. And then this third one, Dead and Gone. But you can read it on its own and it'll be fine.
You know, it's a whole mystery and it makes perfectly good sense. But Joanna is right that it does reveal the denouement of book one. You know, I used to recommend for people who read Elizabeth Peters and her amazing Amelia Peabody series, which I absolutely loved. If you read any book besides the first one, you would never have any suspense reading the first one, The Crocodile on the Sandbank, because you would know.
Yeah.
You know,
sometimes there's no way around it.
No, there really isn't. And, you know, it's tempting in a way to, you know, think, oh, it should have been a standalone. But, you know, on the other hand, it's a great series start. And, you know, so there you are. It's just, that's why you should listen to us and start new authors with the first book. And then you never have this drama because you have been right there from the beginning. Right. Yeah.
Some series you can like come in and out of better. Like the Ellery series, you're not spoiled. The mystery isn't spoiled at all, no matter what book you come in on. But then there's the character progression, which you don't get the full arc of the growth of the characters if you don't start with the first book, but you won't be spoiled. So at least there's that.
There is that, indeed. Well, thank you, Jason. Sorry, try it again. The dog came in and distracted me. Sorry. Scooter was licking his chops because he just got fed. Thank you. It was great to see you again. I'm excited for you that you're finally going to get your trip.
I'm excited too. Long last.
At last, right. So Jacob, more time this afternoon. And let me remind you that we do have copies, autographed copies of Dead and Gone at the store. And we have copies of the second book, which, as Joanne said, just come out in paperback, and also the first book. So if you want, you could buy all three and have a little binge here as we move our way through August. Not a bad plan, all things considered. Anyway, thanks very much for your time, everyone. And thank you, Joanne. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Good night.
Oh, you too. Good to see you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.